Well, hello and welcome to the third episode of the Secular Foxhole Podcast. Martin, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Claire.
Well, this is sort of a milestone already for us. So we have a special guest that we're going to interview today.
So, hello, Andrew Bernstein, fellow podcaster.
Hey. Hi, Martin. Hi, hey, Blair. How you guys doing?
Yeah. We are great.
And it was fun when I sent out the invitation via the ringer, the service that we are using. You had your swoop in your email address, and I remember the heart of Pagan. So I'm glad to hear your voice, Andrew, and talk to you about your literature and other things. And Blair will take the lead here. But again, heart of Pagan and swoop, the character there, a real hero. inspired me. So thanks, Andrew, and thanks for your time here.
Well, you're very welcome, Martin, and I'm glad that Swoop's character and the story in my novel Heart of a Pagan, I'm glad it was meaningful to you. So, thank you for letting me know.
Yeah. Well, let me kick things off with actually a formal introduction of Andrew. Andrew holds a PhD in philosophy from the City University of New York. He is the author of numerous books, including The Capitalist Manifesto, The Historic, Economic, and Philosophic Case for Laissez-Faire, and his most recent, Heroes, Legends, Champions, Why Heroism Matters. He lectures all over the world on myriad topics, and he's a mean-spirited SOB, feared by nuns, puppies, and small children who habitually cross the street to when they see him coming. Andy, are you there?
I'm a real dangerous guy. The nuns flee. The nuns and the puppies flee from me when they see me coming down the block.
And I am a cat person, so Andrew, so it's good. But I'm happy that you did the acronym SOB also, because otherwise we have to put the explicit on the show. So we want to have it clean, but we know that you could have colorful words. So continue, Blair. So.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the Capitalist Manifesto, Andy. I want to quickly go back to that. I don't know if how many of our listeners will be familiar with that book, but I want to mention one thing or ask you one thing. Can you expand on what you meant by the great disconnect in that book?
Oh, yeah. The Capitalist Manifesto was published in 2005, so it's not that long ago. The book is not that old. But the great disconnect is this rupture between capitalism's performance in providing the system of individual rights is in itself the system of freedom, and then economically its performance has helped lift probably hundreds of millions, very possibly billions of human beings by this time out of poverty and into middle class affluence or into wealth relative to the non-capitalist country. So in Western Europe, North America, and Eastern and Central Europe now too, North America and the Asian tigers, Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, South Korea, capitalism's performance has enabled probably billions of people by this time to rise out of poverty into middle-class comfort. And yet the intellectuals overwhelmingly repudiate it. And ironically, a lot of them are Marxists who claim to care about the poor. It's capitalism is the system that is the system for the poor, for the formerly poor, for the poor to rise into middle class affluence. And there's the great disconnect: the capitalism's great performance and virtues on the one hand versus the intellectuals' failure to understand and or appreciate the greatness of capitalism's performance.
I see. That's actually crucial. I mean, it's still going on today, sadly.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, today more, more today than when I wrote it with Antifa and Black Lives Matter, these Marxist terrorist organizations rioting in the streets of many cities and burning down stores and buildings. And one of the stated goals, of course, is to destroy capitalism. You see the signs these Antifa thugs raise, no war but class war, clear Marxist sentiment, which is supposed to be about the poor and the working class and everything. And they want to destroy the only system that enables the poor and the working class to rise up into middle class comfort. Yeah. Brilliant, brilliant That's... reasoning on their part. Right. I say ironically.
Yeah. Yeah, and also the people in power in, you know, Washington and the Beltway. I mean, they are pretty good at destroying capitalism also.
Yeah, they sure are. One party's worse than the other. The Republicans are bad enough, but the Democrats are even worse. So.
And talking about that, when you said two parties, wasn't your manifesto inspired by a party on paper, so to speak, right? The Capitalist Party.
Oh yeah, the Capitalist Party came about 10 years later. I think it was 2015. When the Capitalist Party was formed by Mark Pellegrino, Mark Pellegrino, the actor and Hollywood activist, and Joe Sanders, the businessman, they hired me to write the platform, you know, for the Capitalist Party. So hopefully, at some point, we'll be able to raise money and start to actually run candidates and get out. But the goal here is to use the political forum as a means of educating the voters, the voters to what individual rights would actually mean when applied to all kinds of topical issues, whether it's, abortion or the right to own guns or education or whatever, what individual rights and free markets would actually look like in action. So it would be a great... Yeah, we might even win some local elections. We might even be able to win, some congressional districts at, starting out. But the main point, of course, is to educate the voters as part of the political forum, engaging in the debate to educate the voters as to what individual rights and free markets actually look like in practice.
That'd be ideal.
Yeah.
In more ways than one.
Yes.
Now, I don't think there's any active candidates at this time, though.
No, we don't. No, to have a political party to run candidates, you need money. We need fundraising. It's always money is always an issue. But when we raise the funds, I think we'll be able to find candidates who are qualified. Do you remember when what year was that? Maybe it was right around 2010. Maybe when Stephen Bailey, an objectivist, ran for Congress.
Right.
Yeah. And he was good. He was very knowledgeable. So I think we'll be able to find the candidates. We just need to do the fundraising so we can actually finance our campaign.
Well, that makes sense then. Yes. Yeah. All right. Well, I have to tell you, Andy, this new book of yours, Heroes, from page one, it's extremely inspiring. And what inspired you to write a book about exceptional people like that, both real and fictional?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Blair. I appreciate that. And before I answer your question, I hope you take a few minutes, go up on Amazon and write a 5-star review for it, because that does help promote the book sales.
And we will spread the good word. So,
thank you, Martin. I appreciate it. But to answer the question, I was always a hero worshiper from the time I was a little kid. I don't want to sound, a sad story. If I grew up in a crazy family, and the I'm sure a lot of us have, and the world, is very mixed. It can be vicious at times, and wars and slavery and genocide and all kinds of violent crimes and stuff. So I grew up in a crazy family in what's often a sick world. And I, not always, there are obviously good people in the world too, but, I weaned myself on the side of heroes. I was always a bookworm, and I wore out a path to the local library where I was reading, biographies of George Washington or history of, the Persian War and the way the Greeks were able to defend themselves against the Persians, or whether I was reading, novels like, Shane, or later on, of course, The Fountainhead, or comic books. I was reading, I was always a Marvel comics guy, so whether I was reading about the Avengers or Spider-Man, or, whatever. It was always heroes, and to this day, it's a theme that runs through all my reading. You know, I read about heroes because I'm not interested in reading about anti-heroes or non-heroes or just these poor guys who are just pushed around by crazy families or they're oppressed by the system. You know, in the capitalist system, whatever, they just can't find the inner fortitude to stand up and really make something out of their life. That's not the books I read. I read books about heroes. So I wanted to bring that, to the attention of hopefully many readers and, a proper hero worshiping attitude. And the one thing that heroes have lacked forever is a proper definition or an understanding, of what it means to actually be a hero. And so, my PhD, like you guys said, is in philosophy. So I know the role Socrates played. His crucial role in the development of moral philosophy, because he's the first one we know of to seek rigorous definitions for moral philosophical terms to really show he knew the importance of having exact definitions. And, Plato's dialogues are always, what is justice or what is piety or what is love? He's always seeking definitions for key terms. So in effect, the question here is, what is heroism? And so I'm continuing the tradition that the illustrious tradition Socrates started. So so I tried to get a definition of heroes. I could see people might quibble with this, that, or the other thing, but I think I made a good start, on what it is to be a hero. And hopefully, the 19th century leading thinkers debated this question. It was a big issue, and we're talking about some heavyweight people, whether I agree with them or not. Friedrich Nietzsche, William James, Herbert Spencer, Thomas Carlyle, people like that, big time essayists and philosophers or psychologists were very fascinated by the issue of heroes and generally positive about heroes. It's the anti-hero mentality subsequent to World War I that's been very negative about heroes. So I wanted to revive, the spirit of hero worship and add to it, there's no definitions in any, even Nietzsche, who, much as I disagree with him as a profound thinker, even Nietzsche doesn't provide a definition. So I wanted to at least get a start on what a definition is for heroes and then have an understanding then of what heroes are, what great value they provide to human life, and then, try to rekindle the spirit of hero worship in this culture today.
You will do a great job with your podcast together with Jan Hersey also on... Objective standard. Yeah, so I started listening to the first episode with Frederick Douglass.
Thank you. We just did Charles Darwin today. And I think we're going to do Maria Montessori next week. So we got some real
great,
some real nice. Great heroes. Nice.
Have you watched that series on Maria Montessori that they did in Italy? The series there on her life. That was very inspiring. I don't know exactly when it was,
I'm glad they recognize her because, of course, she was alive when the fascists were control Italy, and although at first, surprisingly, Mussolini, thought that Montessori education would be good, for his goals. That he soon realized that. Training a bunch of independent thinkers was not the way you would install a fascist state. Yeah. She was under state surveillance, and eventually she and her son had to leave the country. And the fascist, not surprisingly, shut down all the Montessori schools during the 1930s.
They got what they deserved. So I'm also impressed with let me first say that the definitions across the board, across all forms of knowledge, are crucial even today, obviously.
Right,
and the way you structured your book too is impressive because when you you talked about the four attributes or characteristics that you use to measure the people you wrote about, can you delve into that some?
Yeah, I was trying to isolate, the attributes of heroes and trying to induce those attributes from examples, to actually tie what it means to be a hero to reality, remembering, Ayn Rand's brilliant definition of rationalism as deduction without reference to reality. I wanted to do this inductively, so I started with a bunch of examples. Having objectivism here is an enormous benefit in a number of ways. Starting out with an inductive method, start out with examples and then pull the principles actually from the example. So it's always the theorizing is always tied to observational reality, to what we can actually observe. But also, okay. Ayn Rand's moral point that life is the standard of moral values really, I think a lot of people have kind of sensed this, that a lot of the stories about heroes, real life or fictional, are people who defended their homeland against invaders, or they fought for liberty, often been limited to warriors, although not always. So I think a lot of people sensed, that heroes take action to promote human life, but not always. I mean, there are people who regarded Hitler as a hero, or Stalin as a hero, or Osama bin Laden as a hero, since this is, 9/11. Mass murderers. There are people who regard mass murderers as heroes. And Ayn Rand's ethics, precludes that and shows us one thing heroes do is they take action in promotion of human life and well-being. And they may have to kill other people, but it's in self-defense or it's in defense of liberty. They're not the aggressors. They're not the, the Hitlers, the Stalins, the Bin Ladens. They're not the ones who initiate use of force. So, great movie a few years ago. Now I'm forgetting. Darkest Hour. About when Churchill first became prime minister in England, right around the time of Dunkirk. Yep. Great film. Yeah, if you haven't seen it, strongly recommend it. I think Gary Oldman won the best actor. This is before Hollywood became completely, racist. It's unbelievable how racist they are. But I know it's sickening. It's not fun. I shouldn't laugh. Anyhow, So Churchill is a hero. I mean, he stood up for freedom against the Nazis and then also against the Soviets. He recognized the evils of communism, the murderous nature of these this totalitarian.
And he went to the source also. He read the books by Adolf Hitler and Stalin and others. So he knew the enemy, and he could see the ominous parallels and the parallels between them and links. So. But not so many listen to him.
Yeah, not enough. By the way, Martin, you reminded me, a little known hero he'd give a shout out to. Lawrence Reed, he's the president of FEE, the Foundation for Economic Education, wrote a nice book, Real Heroes. And it differs from my book. They complement each other nicely because his book is a bunch of short biographies of what a bunch of heroes have done, some of them well-known, some of them not so well-known. And my book is a theoretical book on the nature of heroes. Anyhow, one of the heroes he discussed, Catherine Athol, who I had never even heard of, it was a member of parliament from Scotland. She was the one who read Hitler. She was the one who heard his speeches. She was the one who warned Churchill that the English... Okay. The English translations of Mein Kampf was evidently whitewashed of all of the crimes that Hitler had had said he was going to perpetrate. She was the one who stood up and told Churchill and gave him the full translations of Mein Kampf and the full recordings of Hitler's speeches and she's unfortunately forgotten today. She stood up against Neville Chamberlain, leader of her own party, when he appeased Hitler and Chamberlain went after her and made sure she was defeated in the next election. So she's a real principled supporter of freedom and individual rights that we should mention here. But what makes her a hero? She's standing up for liberty, against both, first the Soviets and then the Nazis.
That's great.
That's one. And she's a real hero. That's deserves great. Our. Deserves a recognition. So, so action in support of human life, heroes, the epic heroes that I think were the first ones to be recognized as heroes have ability or prowess, beyond that of every man or every woman. I mean, Churchill had remarkable leadership skills and oratory skills in fiction. You know, Howard Roark is the main character of The Fountainhead is a genius. You know, most of us aren't. In real life, Ayn Rand is a genius. Most of us aren't. You know, and, you know, it's the great warriors rather than just the rank and file guys who are, you know, recognized as you know, the ones who have the prowess, the ones who have the most ability, whether, you know, as a good fictional example, who I love is Sherlock Holmes, because he's simply, he's the smartest guy in the room, you know? And I mean, he simply sees things that nobody else sees. And he puts his genius in service of human life to, you know, to identify murderers or to foil their attempt at murder. You know, rather he puts his genius in service of human life rather than in service of being a criminal himself, unlike, say, you know, Professor Moriarty, who is a formidable villain. But, you know, so heroes have great prowess, whether it's in, whether it's intellectual, bodily, or some combination of, you know, of the two. They face, they're undaunted in the face of obstacles that would, you know, dismay a lesser man or woman. And here, one of my favorite examples, real life, that I used in the book is the great Antarctic explorer, Ernest Shackleton. You know, Shackleton and his party faced the most unbelievable obstacles to survive. It's the most amazing survival story in history, with the possible exception of Apollo 13. You know, and Shackleton said, obstacles are just things to be overcome. You know, and that's a hero's attitude.
Right? That's the attitude, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That is obstacles, they face down, you know, daunting obstacles that would dismay a lesser man. And the fourth characteristic is, in some form, they achieve victory. Even if, you know, like with Cyrano, to take another fictional example, you know, his plays are never produced. His love for Roxanne is never consummated. He dies. He's murdered, you know, cowardly. He's ambushed and murdered by his enemies. But his undying allegiance to his own principles, you know, his refusal to compromise with his soul, his undaunted independence and integrity, it's an inspiration. He certainly achieves moral victory. He dies unbowed, morally unbowed, and he's an inspiration to readers, you know, for well over 100 years now.
That's true. That's true. Another thing you mentioned that I liked also is you talked about the everyman, if you will, and the possibility of him becoming heroic at his own scale, if you will. Can you elaborate that a little bit?
Yeah, because we just, that's a good question, because we just talked about the epic heroes, you know, these giants, these larger-than-life figures. And yet, every man and every woman can rise to heroic heights, too. You know, they may differ in scale, but, you know, but still, you know, hero has undaunted or undismayed pursuit of life-giving values and in accordance with one's own ability. So you see people, you know, who for example, they may not want to, you know, defeat the world's mightiest empire and found a nation, a free republic like George Washington. But yeah, they want to, they want to be the first member of their family to graduate from college, or they want to start their own business, or they want to write a book, or they want to rear a family of healthy children, or, you know, psychologically healthy as well as physically healthy. You know, there's these true stories of a pregnant woman who's the doctor saying, you know, you're going to lose the pregnancy, you know, it's dangerous. And she'll do whatever it takes. She'll stay in bed for 9 months if necessary, because she wants to have the baby, you know, and that's a very positive, life affirming goal. And her attitude is whatever it takes. And that's a hero's attitude. And people who face cancer or some horrible disease, I'm going to fight it because life is of value, and I'm going to fight the disease and, you know, something with great courage. And sometimes they survive and sometimes they don't. But they fight the disease, you know, with great courage. These are heroic, these are heroic deeds.
Absolutely.
And they're often inspired. Yeah, you know, they're often inspired by the epic heroes. You know,
Sure.
I mean, I've known somebody. Yeah, I know somebody who was fighting cancer, and thank God, you know, she survived. And she was a big Shackleton fan, had read Alfred Lansing's book Endurance, and was a great admirer of Shackleton. And, you know, and people like that are at, and I'm a hero worshiper, our attitude is often, you know, what would this great champion, you know, in my case, is usually Howard Roark, you know, that for me embodies, you know, from the Fountainhead, that embodies the essence of heroism. What would Howard Roark do in this situation? Or, you know, what would Shackleton do in this situation? You know, and face up to the reality, however painful it might be, and fight for life, or fight for whatever the, stand up and fight for whatever the value is, because it's that important. And so, yeah, every man and every woman could often rise to heights of heroism. We don't have to have tremendous genius or the kind of mental and bodily toughness that Shackleton had. Don't necessarily, or the gunfighting ability of a Shane or somebody like that. We don't have to have this kind of epic prowess. What we do have to have is an undaunted courage in support of our highest values against whatever the, you know, enormous obstacles or dangers or impediments that may lie in our path.
That's great. Yeah, that's great, Andy. One of the things you also, you don't shy away from covering, and I appreciate as well, is that you talk about people like our founders, who obviously one of the greatest achievements in human history, creating the United States, but they were morally flawed and being slave owners and so on. Today, again, with our cultural disintegration, I think it's crucial, again, to stand up for what the achievements they made, and not focus solely on the fact of their flaws.
Right?
Do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And the American founders are a good example. Now the Virginians were all slave owners, and I use Thomas Jefferson, you know, as an example in the book as a morally flawed hero. But we should also point out, in fairness, that all of the Northern founders were abolitionists. You know, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, who freed his own slaves, in large part because of the principles of the Revolution. Thomas Paine, Alexander Hamilton, they were all abolitionists. But the Virginians were all slave owners, although they were Jefferson and Madison were theoretical abolitionists, although they never actually acted on it in their own lifetime. But the Jefferson's a good example because, on the one hand, he was a seriously flawed person. He took his role in the Joseph Ellis's book Founding Brothers is very good on this. It's really eye opening. And Ellis, he's an American historian, and he I think his PhD's from Yale maybe,
could be.
He's a brilliant writer, and they say makes history come alive. On the one hand, he points out all the flaws with unflinching honesty. At the same time, he appreciates the magnitude of achievement here. And So Jefferson was a main player in the vicious political party wars of the 1790s. I had a scandal monger to write some vicious screed, dishonest screed about John Adams, who had been his, revolutionary ally and buddy, but he stabbed him in the back dishonestly and then denied culpability, for that. I had nothing to do with that. Joseph Ellis put it brilliantly, that Jefferson conducted an artful minuet with duplicity. How's that for saying he was a freaking liar, in this regard? And of course, he was a slave owner. An individualist and an abolitionist in theory, but a slave owner in practice. So, he's a hypocrite. So there's a lot of flaws there, but at the same time, we can't overlook, we're not throwing out the baby with the bath here. The leftists want to do that, but they're irrational. We recognize that, he was an early and outspoken proponent of American independence from Great Britain. He was the lead author, of the Declaration of Independence. He was a founder of the University of Virginia. He donated his massive book collection to found the Library of Congress. I mean, he was a staunch, outspoken supporter of religious freedom. you know, we can go on and on singing. Most of all, Jefferson was an individualist. And right. and in many cases stood up individualism and could partly understand his fears about emancipation, which he supported because, you know, he favored emancipation of slaves by slowly, by degrees. He feared that there would be a civil war over this that would tear the nascent republic apart. And who could deny that he was right, you know,
well, right.
About that. He was obviously prescient. I mean, he died in, mm-hmm. 26? So, I mean, you know, 40 years.
It was before. Right around the corner, yeah.
Yeah. He saw it coming.
Right around the corner. Yeah.
Right. And so,
boy.
So he had monumental virtues. And I think what justifies us, we rationally, with somebody like that, you know, we acknowledge a morally flawed hero. We acknowledge the flaws, we deplore them, and then we focus on the life-giving achievements. Because in life, what did Ayn Rand put it brilliantly? You know, it's more important to reward the good than it is to punish the evil, because the good is that which promotes life, and that's what we need to focus on, the life-giving, the life-sustaining, the life-promoting, and that's why we deplore Jefferson's flaws here. We deplore the truth from his biographers that Thomas Edison, you know, brought children into the world and then neglected them. That's not a good thing to do. You know, if you're going to have children, if you're going to bring children into the world, they deserve quality time from mom and dad. So, you know, we acknowledge the flaws, we deplore them, but we focus. Though that does, you know, let's put it this way. There's a lot of people who were liars and slave owners. There's only one guy who wrote the Declaration of Independence. And there's a lot of people who ignored their children. There's only one guy who invented the electric lighting system, you know, and those achievements, you know, advance human life enormously. And that's why we honor, you know, these heroes as the great men they were, even though they did have, you know, moral flaws that we acknowledge and we censure.
And I will do a comment there on this topic and also the name of our podcast, The Secular Foxhole, that Blair brilliantly came up with his blog. So would you say the historical context with the Founding Fathers, because this show will be aired also around the world, if you have a history thing there, the Founding Fathers, they had the foundation, but then the lack, as you said, in different ways. How crucial were they there? Some were free thinkers, some was deist, some were religious. And could you, you know, what the situation we are in here today? Do you have any? Right. It could be a follow-up episode in the future, of course, because it's a big topic. But the Founding Fathers and the base and the foundation and the, how to say, the gap there that we see now, what's going on over a long time.
Yeah, I think there's a lot that we could say about the founders if you want to do a follow-up show in the future. Regarding slavery.
Yes, please.
Yeah, we always have to remember, this is the 18th century. Slavery had existed forever, literally forever. I mean,
exactly.
Orlando Patterson wrote the definitive book on the history of slavery. What is it? Slavery and Social Death, I think is the title. He goes into, you know, slavery all over the world, going back, you know, forever. And Thomas Sowell's culture series, you know, he talks about, you know, slavery, every part of the world going back into prehistory. So there's no abolitionist movement. There were people who opposed slavery. The Roman Stoics did. But there was no concerted abolitionist movement until Great Britain during the 18th century Enlightenment. When the principle of, you know, the Lockean principle of individual rights is starting to gain cultural currency on both sides of the pond. And it's the principle of individual rights that not only gives rise to capitalism and a free society against monarchies and aristocracies and so forth, but it's the same principle that gives rise to abolitionism. So historically and logically. So capitalism and abolitionism are intellectual, moral siblings. You know, both of them stress the principle of individual rights. Why should we not be subject to a king? Because we have a right to our own life. Why is it wrong to enslave somebody? Because, you know, that person has a right to his or her own life. So this is a revolutionary development in the 18th century. So, you know, in fairness to the American founders, I mean, when Thomas Jefferson was born, what, 1740 something in the 1740s?
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think 1740s to 1820s, I think. You know, he was born into a world where slavery was simply unchallenged. Anywhere in the world, there was no abolitionist movement until he was a young man. And he was one of the revolutionaries who really pushed forward the principle of individual rights. So, in a way, criticizing the Virginians for being slave owners is like criticizing them for, well, you guys weren't revolutionary enough, you know? So we can criticize them for that because they were revolutionaries and they didn't apply it in their own lives. So we can accuse them of hypocrisy. But the bottom line to me is this. American principles are right. American practice has been inconsistent. And so we can criticize American hypocrisy, but we have to revere American principles. That's, you know, and then those principles must be applied universally and consistently. And here's a big difference between the Nazis and communists. The Nazis and communists are principled mass murderers. You know, the Nazis believe in race war. And when they put their race war principles into action, they murdered 20 million people. And the communist principle is class war. When they put their class war principles into action, they murdered 100 million people, or maybe more. The American principles are individual rights. When they put those principles into action, you had freedom and abolitionism and an end to slavery. The Americans went wrong when they contradicted their principles. So there's a life-giving difference. There's a life and death difference between, you know, the Americans and the Nazis on one hand, and the Nazis and communists on the other.
That's I couldn't have said it better. Yeah.
Well, that's why you guys pay me the big bucks to be on the show, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And we will come to that. So, Andrew, we could talk about. So please plug, where could listeners find you and how could they support you? For example, by Patreon.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Well, my website is andrewbernstein.net and my Patreon account is up there. So if you want to support me in any amount that's affordable. We're egoists. We don't ask for people to make sacrifices. But if my work is a value.
We are poor capitalists, but we will spread the good word and ship in a symbolic dollar. Do you take silver dollars also? Real money?
Definitely. There are students on my Patreon account who put in like $5 a month, and I'm very touched by that because to a student,
that's great.
You know, $5 a month is a lot. So. That helps support my writing if you contribute to my Patreon account. And like I said, if you guys love, my website is, andrewbernstein.net. And if you guys love the Hero Book, please go up on Amazon, write a 5-star review because we're going to turn this book into an Amazon bestseller and, reach as many people as we can.
And it is in paperback and Kindle. Do you plan to do it in audio a book also?
We just completed the audio book.
Wow.
Sean Salisbury, who does the audio for the Objective Standard, just completed.
Oh, nice. Great.
And, it's going through a quality check right now from the producer. So passes the quality check, as I think it will, then within a month, the audio book will join Kindle and paperback, available on Amazon.
Great news.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Andy, can we do one more quick question with you?
Yeah, sure.
Obviously, today is the 19th anniversary of 9/11. We've been talking about exceptional people and America as an exceptional country. Can you just give us a vision of a hopeful human future for America to not only survive but thrive in the future?
Yeah. This past year and the endless riots and everything and the cultural dominance that the insane left has in the United States. Now I'm almost as pessimistic now as Leonard Peikoff, but not quite. If there'd been no Ayn Rand, then I would be pessimistic. But Ayn Rand's accomplishments, especially in Atlas Shrugged, she wrote, in my judgment, the two greatest novels in world literature, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, and I'll stand by that assessment till the day I die. These amazing stories. And in Atlas Shrugged, of course, she dramatized her philosophy of objectivism. Didn't just talk about it. Opar is brilliant. And Leonard Peikoff's book, Objectivism, Philosophy of Ayn Rand, is brilliant as a nonfiction presentation. But most people are going to be introduced to Ayn Rand's philosophy through Atlas Shrugged. She dramatized it. She showed it. This is just talk about it. Vividly dramatized. And of course, Atlas Shrugged has been translated into almost every language on Earth. And today, educated people all read English, so they could read Ayn Rand in the original. So, you know, there's hope. And that's the way, and with social media and podcasting and, you know, the internet and websites and everything, we have, you know, an unprecedented opportunity to promote Ayn Rand's ideas and to let people know about Atlas Shrugged and introduce people to it. So I do think the long term, you know, people will be reading Ayn Rand more and more. It takes a long time to change any culture.
Sure.
You know, yeah. I mean, look how the struggle to abolish slavery, you know, well, John Hersey and I just did a show on William Wilberforce and the long struggle, you know, to abolish slavery. You know, it takes a long time. You know, from the Dark Ages to the Renaissance was a long, painful struggle. But what Atlas Shrugged, you know, the power of Ayn Rand's writing and the truth of her philosophy in the long run will win. I don't know how long it'll take. The short term is obviously pretty grim, but I think the longer into the future we project our vision, the greater our, you know, the greater our magnitude of success will be. So I absolutely think, you know, that we'll win the intellectual moral battle in time, and we'll establish free society. Maybe it'll be in North America. Maybe it'll be somewhere else where, you know, the ideas will catch hold and rekindle the spirit of individual reason, individual rights, and political economic liberty. I think I think they'll never die now from the face of the earth because of Ayn Rand. Those principles will always be kept alive somewhere because people are reading and understanding and Ayn Rand and standing up as heroes, standing up for those values in the face of, you know, concerted opposition. So I long term, yes, I think we'll win this battle.
Thanks, Andy.
And who would you like to listen to in a future episode as a guest we could have?
Oh, that's a good question. Let me think for a minute. So somebody,
you will come another time, of course. But who will do some other individual?
I'm trying to think outside the box. Obviously, you know, objectivist intellectuals are good. People who fascinate me, and who fascinates me, I don't know if you'd be able to get him or not. But somebody who fascinates me, even though he's a mixed case, is Elon Musk, because SpaceX, we're going to Mars. You know, I mean, that's just fascinating. You know, so. But he's a big superstar. So I don't know if you could get him to come on the show or not.
Maybe about 5 years from now.
build up your audience. Yeah, SpaceX will be building, you know, launching pads on the moon to get ready to send men to Mars. Right?
Who listen to podcasts on Mars? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, man will be an interplanetary species, Elon Musk says. But you know, amongst objectivists who I think would be would probably be interested to come on your show. You guys know Aaron Briley?
I know.
Well, I could introduce you to him. He's an objectivist. He's got a PhD in philosophy. He's a black American guy, and you know, the left has this idea that if you're not a leftist, then you ain't black. And, you know, for blacks to support capitalism, whether it's Thomas Sowell or Walter Williams or Larry Elder or the whole bunch, or Candace Owens, a whole bunch of heroes.
It was great,
you know, is a real independent. And Aaron Briley's an objectivist, and he's got a lot of interesting things to say, you know, as a young black guy growing up in the United States. So he'd be an interesting guest for you to have on. If you want, let me know. I'll put you in touch with him.
Yes, please. Thanks.
Yeah, by all means. You're welcome.
All right. Well, listen, Andrew Bernstein has been our guest. Andy, thanks for visiting the Foxhole today.
Yeah, well, you're welcome. Your foxholes aren't normally the most, you know, appetizing place to be in, because it usually denotes where, you know, we're at war and the enemy's blasted away at us and we're ducking down into a foxhole. But in a way, we are at war and we are secularists, yep. So it's well named, and it's been a great pleasure to be on the show, guys. It's been fun. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. All right, Andy.